Well, welcome. We do one of these studies usually in the fall and one in the spring. Usually it's time. This one will be 8 weeks long, and it's on the book of Galatians. And so welcome to class number one. Usually, if you're this is the way this always works, you know, I start teaching, and then the first class, a lot of people aren't there, and the first few minutes, a lot of people aren't there. And I say all these things that I wish that everybody knew. So the time it builds up a little about the middle of the study, I think, yeah, but I said all that stuff the first week, you know, and I don't like to repeat it. But usually if you're at home reading the Bible, I mean, I don't think the average person is real conscious about what they're doing. I mean, they're looking for comfort. They're looking for the voice of the Lord to reconnect spiritually. So they read a familiar passage of Scripture, and it brings that light into their life. But it's not exactly study. They're not thinking strongly about the context of what they're reading. And they're not examining real closely. Well, I'm in this particular part of the Bible, and this is the immediate context. This is when this was written, by whom this was written, to whom it was written. What is the style of this particular part of the Bible? That's not the stuff that like when you're in bed reading the Bible that takes over your mind. At least not the average person, I think. But it's really important, I think, when you're actually studying the Bible, to ask those questions consciously of yourself. Well, what is this I'm looking at? And not just what is it and what are the contexts, who wrote it, to whom, when, where. Because if you think about this, the Bible is written over, it's a collection of books written over thousands of years, literally, and in several languages, in several cultural contexts, and it's got several types of literature in it. In other words, it's not all one type of literature. And you don't read things the same depending on what they are. I mean, you read a menu differently than you read an encyclopedia, differently than you read history. You read a poem differently than you read a newspaper. And yet the Bible has all these kinds of literature. And I say you probably make these adjustments kind of unconsciously when you're, like I said, just reading devotionally at home. But it's a time to when you're studying the Bible, to look at that stuff closely. And it's also saying, well, how will I approach this? What kind of literature is it, and how am I going to approach this? And so if we're looking at Galatians, we're in the New Testament, of course, and that's the first thing to think about. I mean, there's a difference between the Old Testament and the New Testament. The Old Testament describes the development of Jewish religion. It's written in Hebrew. It's written within a very specific context of Israel, Palestine. I mean, it doesn't rarely reaches beyond those boundaries. But of course, the New Testament is the story of Jesus Christ, and the bulk of the New Testament after the Gospels is the story of the Gospel going out around the Roman Mediterranean world. Its geographic range is far more, it's widespread, and so you're looking at other things. So Galatians is in the New Testament. And we're looking at a gospel then. We're looking at Jesus Christ, and we're looking at the church going out into the world. Now, I'm sure you know something about Galatians. What is it?
I think it's grace being a
theme. Oh, yeah. Well, thematically, sure. Grace is a big theme in it. But what is it? As literature, what is it? It's a letter. It's considered one of the it's a letter to whom? To the Galatians. Okay, well, that's important, but that means there are different kinds of letters. Now, the big word, of course, is epistle. You know, you all know that. It's an epistle. Now, remember, this isn't just any old letter. I mean, this isn't a post-it note. I mean, there were kind of rules and ideas about how you wrote a letter back then, especially if you were addressing a group of people. And you can tell by the name Galatians that you're addressing a group of churches in this case. So it's a formal letter. It's not just, hey, you know, I was, you know, whipping off an email to somebody and just thought I'd say hi. I mean, you have a very formal address to a group of churches in a region called Galatia. And so that begins to say, all right, I'm going to think about that when I'm reading it, that this is a letter to a group of churches. Now, when you say, well, we interpret different kinds of literature different ways, what kind of things might you run into if you're reading a letter to a group of churches that you might want to keep in mind when you're interpreting? Who they were. And why would you want to know who they were?
To know what to write?
Well, yeah, if you're the writer, of course you'll know. Well, I guess the question is that there would be things that would be very specifically true in a letter. You write a letter to a group of churches for a reason. Chances are there are problems there. There are situations there. There are emphases, quirks. There would be things that might be true only about those churches or especially true about those churches, and those would be the things you would address. And so you're always aware of this when you're reading an epistle that, well, yes, this is written to me, in the 21st century, but at the same time, if I'm going to take the context very seriously, it was written to them. And there will be some things in any letter that you read in the New Testament that don't have any immediate application for you. God gave you this. I mean, I'm not making this up, but I mean, you know, if Paul says, bring the cloak I left in Troas, you think, well, yeah, I was looking at that this morning and I was really convicted. I don't know. And the church will create a ritual called the cloak at Troas. Every morning we'll send a young person out to pull a coat off the rack and bring it back in to reenact, you know, the cloak I brought at Troas. Well, it's in there. And of course there are people greeted, you know, greet Aretas, you know, or greet the city treasurer or something. Okay, well, that's cool. You know, it shows you that... I mean, it authenticates the scriptures that these were written to real people in real situations, but there are these things that defy immediate application for us as 21st century Christians. And there are some things that probably are being addressed in those specific churches that are a little bit of a reach for us and might not have even been true about all the churches that were being addressed. So that's one thing. Keep this in mind while we're looking at it. We're in the New Testament. We're in a gospel that's gone into the Greek and Roman world. We're addressing a group of churches, and it's a formal letter, and it elaborates some things that are necessary for the Galatians. It's always been considered one of the chief epistles of Paul. It's a lot like the book of Romans. And some of them are written to Timothy or to Titus, but this one's written to this group, and it develops a lot of ideas formally. This comes from the International Standard Bible Encyclopedia. This is a letter of expostulation. That's a great term. Yeah, this just elaborates on things. Passion and argument are blended in it. Well, that's good. I like this. Hot indignation and righteous scorn. Say, all right, I'm getting sucked in here. I'm kind of like that, you know. You're not going to be bored, are you? Tender, wounded affection. Okay, that's if you got worried about hot indignation. You say, okay, this isn't going to be a drag here. Well, if your conscience is tender, we've got that. Deep sincerity and manly integrity. I like that. Manly integrity. This is an earlier edition of the International Standard Bible Encyclopedia. You just don't talk about manly integrity anymore. United with the loftiest consciousness of spiritual authority. Above all, a consuming devotion to the person and cross of the Redeemer fill these pages with an incomparable wealth and glow of Christian emotion. The power of mind the epistle exhibits matches its largeness of heart. Romans, indeed, carries out the argument. So if you're into the letters, you think, well, Galatians was a start, and maybe Romans was a more elaborate kind of development of the epistle here. When was it written, and how does this work? Well, once again... We'll dig into this, but it's complicated. And of course, if there are different ideas about when Paul wrote it and exactly what the circumstances were that were transpiring in the churches at that time. But let me he asks, why bother doing the study thing? Why bother starting to ask like the context questions, all this stuff I've just thrown out? Is it worth it? And what would be its worth? To be conscious about what you're looking at and how you're going to approach it. Oh, yeah. Well, and what does it protect you from, I guess? Right. I mean, I couldn't put it better. I mean, the technical theological term, goofy interpretation. I mean, it's possible. You know, the Bible will not endorse you for saying, I can just pick up the Bible and understand. I don't need to think about all that stuff you're going on about right now. I don't need to know the word epistle. I'm just going to pick it up, and I'm going to read it, and I'm going to get it. And I don't need to look any deeper. Well, you could have that attitude, but I don't think the Bible will support you in that. I mean, I don't think the Bible will say, yeah, open me up and you can just interpret me any old way flying on automatic pilot. You can come up with some pretty goofy interpretation. And one way to protect yourself from that is to say, what did this mean as the original writer wrote it, and how did the original reader read it? And that would be a first step, I think, in any evangelical church, the saying, how do you interpret the Bible? Well, try to find out what the original author, what the author meant to say and to whom he meant to say it and how they would have interpreted it. At that point, though, you're free. We'd say that there's only one interpretation of Scripture, and it's going to be heavily anchored to that context. What did it mean to the original reader? But one interpretation, many applications, is how I would put it. There can't be more than one interpretation of it. I mean, that would be to say that, just to be uncorked the bottle and say, well, anything, you know, when I read that, I see it talking about Sears and Roebuck. You know, I say, well, who's to tell me I'm wrong? You know, well, all right, if that's the way it is. But no, there's one interpretation. That would be sound Bible scholarship. But many applications. You could take it and find ways to apply it. And there you're free. You're free to exercise your imagination. You're free to let the Holy Spirit speak to you to say, well, how does that then reach to me? So keep this in mind, too. I'm working on one interpretation based on the context, on the study of the context, self-consciously trying to think, how am I going to approach the Bible? But then there are many applications. And yours might not be mine in that sense. I mean, it just might not grab you the same way it grabs me at this time. So that's how we're going at it here with this particular study. I love the book of Galatians. I've always loved it. It's been one of my favorites my entire Christian life. And that's an interesting thing because in some ways we talk about the many applications of the immediate situation in Galatians, like nothing that's happened in my life. I mean, there's nothing that's really worked on me spiritually. You'll see what I have up there is a map, of course, and Paul's missionary journeys. Now we'll look at some of these in a little more detail, but let me just give you the overview here. You know that Paul, of course, is a Pharisee, a rabbi. He becomes a Christian. He has a miraculous conversion in Acts chapter 9. He converts to Jesus Christ, and he becomes then the leader of a church in Antioch. You can see it over there on your right, way over there. That becomes the first big center of Gentile Christianity. And that's, you know, people are not necessarily from Jewish backgrounds. And so that's the first real energy of that. And you'll know what else is famous about Antioch. It's the first place where Christians were called Christians, remember? I mean, they needed a definition that was outside their Jewish context. A laser pointer. Wonderful. Yes, thank you. Except, there it is. We are now lasering Antioch. It would be in current Turkey, I believe that would be. It would sort of floats around Syria and Turkey, depending on what you're doing with it. The other thing that happens in Antioch, maybe more consciously than in the other churches, perhaps because it's a Gentile church, is this is where we'll see the launching of a mission movement, right? The Holy Spirit says, set aside for me. And through prayer and fasting, they decide that it's time to take the message out. And so Paul, of course, once again, one of the people chosen, decides to take a tour of both his home area, which would be Cilicia, and you'll see the first journey is the Green Line. It leaves Antioch, he goes through the island of Cyprus, he comes up into this area and turns around and comes back. And then later he will take a second journey. It'll be a little more elaborate. It's the red line there. And it goes, let's see, where my arrow's going this way up through here, and you'll see that it gets quite complicated. And then there's actually, some people say a third journey, but actually he takes that under duress because he's under arrest and being led back to Rome at that point, as I understand it. The question is, this becomes Paul's life. This is how he lives, traveling as a kind of an itinerant evangelist, church planter. He gets back to Antioch. He does different things. The irony of this is that he will spend much of his time as a jailbird at this point. He gets thrown in the slammer a couple of times in local prisons, but more importantly, he'll be arrested in Jerusalem, get parked is it up here? No, it's not. Caesarea for a while. He might be there as long as 2 years under some kind of house arrest or something like that. And then he gets taken to Rome when he spends some years there, apparently, in jail. And there's some debate because the book of Acts ends up with him, so to speak, in the slammer. It's actually a house arrest, but it leaves you dangling there at the end of the book of Acts, and there's a lot of debate. Does he get out? Or does he get led right to his own execution at that point? Or does he get out? And there's the theory that he gets out and goes to Spain and comes back, gets arrested again. And then, you know, you've heard all this stuff probably if you're a Bible student. You know how it goes. The question is, when did he have time to write? Well, he had time to write when he was in jail, so to speak, or when he was under arrest. Now, the question is, when did he write? And a lot of people debate this one. It would seem that the book of Galatians might be written at a very specific time when the tensions between the Jewish Christians and the new Gentile church that is growing up have really blossomed. And in Acts chapter 15, they hold a council in Jerusalem. They pass certain sort of ideas about how to iron out these relationships. And perhaps Paul is in a sense, writing the book of Galatians in response to that conference in Acts chapter 15. That's one theory. There are other theories about when he writes it. What to say about it? Well, to whom? Now, this gets even thicker. Who are the Galatians, for heaven's sakes? Well, that would make an interesting study, wouldn't it? Now, for the longest time, the church believed what's called the Northern Galatian theory. And the Galatians in that theory are these people up in here. Now, this would be modern Turkey, but these people weren't the same genetic stock of the Turks. Now, there are people who believe, because when Rome came in and took over this area, they called the southern area, the political jurisdiction, also was Galatia. See how the squiggly lines map out this other area down in the south? So in order to hire lots of Bible scholars and give them jobs and pay them money to write articles, you have them arguing over whether Galatians is written to the northern Galatians or the southern Galatians. And every once in a while, fist fights break out and all kinds of things happen. It's not true. They do fight. The longest time, everybody was North Galatian. Then the early 19th century, then it became the Southern Galatian theory, really got traction. Everybody believed it. You were a fool if you didn't believe the Southern Galatian theory. And now it's North Galatian again. You know, people like North Galatian. The North Galatia theory here. But who are these people? And why would you want to know? Well, if you're writing to the, you know, like if you're like thinking of the Old Testament and you're writing to Jews, you kind of get a sense of the character of the Jewish nation, the Jewish people and its different eras, you know, and things like that. But you don't have that advantage when you're looking at Galatia. If you're looking in the Bible, there's no real, we'll look at it. They're mentioned all through the New Testament. We'll look at a couple of these places, but you don't really know a lot about them unless you try to draw it out of some other kind of history. And you can, because the Romans were very interested in this area, and lots of Roman historians wrote about this group of people. Name Gaul mean anything to you? Gaul? Yeah. It was actually Gaul. They had come over from, they'd settled in this area of central Turkey a few centuries before the time of Christ. They came and dominated. These were fair-skinned people, the Galatians, and they were actually Celts. They were like the Irish in Turkey. Oh, no wonder. Well, lots of people like this, and you know, this was one of the ideas of discredit. But these are like the Irish in Turkey or something, and I don't know what's become of them. I guess suppose they intermarried into it. But the idea that this was a Celtic group of people there. What do you think when you think of Celtic people? Ah, yeah. No. I think about this with my students a lot because, you know, I mean, if you're hanging around Mennonite church, what ethnic group are you primarily around? Oh, yeah, here's German is Otto himself, you know, but it's as, you know, might say, but, you know, some of us could be as Irish as Paddy's pig, you know, I mean, my part of my lineage is Irish, you know, and I think, why would I think about Irish people? Aren't they? He says good music. I think they're kind of passionate people. People who aren't afraid to embrace the lost, quixotic cause, and an artistic bent. You know, and you know, you can just imagine that the English were Anglo-Saxons, and of course the English and the Irish were tremendous friends. They've always gotten along really well. And I tried to pull that up, and I pulled it off here. It's very interesting, because in the early days of some of this Bible scholarship, they would talk about them. You could get the feeling like the English scholars were reading the Irish into the Galatians and some of their own English snobbery about the Irish. But this from Adam Clark, for example. The religion of ancient Galatia was extremely corrupt and superstitious, and they are said to have worshipped the mother of gods under the name Agdistis and to have offered human sacrifices of the prisoners they took in war. They are mentioned by historians as tall and valiant people, who went nearly naked, and used for arms only a sword and a buckler. It's a buckler. Be thou my buckler, my sword. It's a buckler. Yeah, it's a shield. Arms only a sword and a buckler. The impetuosity of their attack is stated to have been irresistible, and this generally made them victorious. Okay. So you turn these people into Christians, what do you suppose happens? These are more ancient pictures of them. I just say it's fascinating to read an earlier thing. It's so hard to say when you talk about character issues and national interests and things like that. I just said these are early opinions. Their character as shown in this epistle is in entire consonance with that ascribed to the Gallic race by all writers. Caesar, commentaries on the Gallic War, the infirmity of the Gauls is that they are fickle in their resolve and fond of change and not to be trusted. My Irish ancestry is getting impetuous about now, but sorry. So theory, quoted by Alfred, frank, impetuous, impressible, eminently intelligent, I like that, but at the same time, extremely changeable, inconstant, fond of show, perpetually quarrying, the fruit of excess vanity. Okay, well, that's There's some opinions from the ancient world about the kind of people you met in Galatia. Okay, so we have it there. But clearly this would be been mitigated. You have to be very careful about national stereotypes and things like that. But I just thought you might be interested to know that kind of stuff is around. So what have we got? We're looking at an epistle that's written to a group of churches. It could be the Southern Galatian theory. It could be the Northern Galatia theory. If it's the Northern Galatian theory, then you're probably dealing with a group of people who are of a Celtic background and things like that. It's a letter. It will have formal rules of a letter, and we see something of this. Paul gets up into that area. We're not quite sure when he wrote this in his career, but as I said, we'll look at some of the other things. Galatians is mentioned a lot in the scriptures. If you have a Bible there, look at the book of Acts, for example. Give you a moment to get there, and we'll just sort of try to track down some of the places where the gospel starts bumping into Galatia. Galatia. Acts 9:23, for example. No, I got that wrong. I got my reference wrong here again, as always. Not right. I've put down the wrong chapter reference here, and now I'm confused. Give me one moment to reorient myself here. I'm very sorry about that. Yeah, there we go. I'm in chapter 18. I'm sorry. I don't know how I wrote chapter 9 down. I was hoping it would at least be chapter 19, and I could make excuses for myself that way. But chapter 18, 18:23, for example. When he had landed in Caesarea and gone up and greeted the church, he went down to Antioch. This is Paul coming back from his missionary. After he had spent some time there, he departed and went over to the region of Galatia and Phrygia, in order, strengthening all the disciples. So there we see him making that trip. He'll show up, I think, at 26 again. No, I've got another bad reference here. Sorry. In Acts, he'll keep wandering in and out of that area at least once. Some people think twice. It would have to be implied twice and going back through the area. In 1 Corinthians 16, verses 1, Paul had made a collection of the churches to take it back to the church in Jerusalem as an offering. There was going to be a famine there, and so he collected money from the Gentile Christians to show good faith to the Christian brothers and sisters. And so, now concerning the collection for the saints, as I have given orders to the churches of Galatia, so you must do also. He's telling the Corinthians this. Paul isn't the only one who gets involved in the life of the church in this region. Peter mentions it as well. 1 Peter 1:1, Peter, an apostle of Jesus Christ, to the pilgrims of the dispersion in Pontus, Galatia, Cappadocia, Asia, and Bithynia. And you'll see him there. I dread going back to the book of Acts since all my chapter references are wrong here, but I will look at 16:6 and hope I got it right for a change. Once again, first missionary journey. When they had gone through Phrygia and the region of Galatia, they were forbidden by the Holy Spirit to preach the word of God in Asia. You see where Asia is there? I mean, we think of Asia as, China and the Orient. That's one of the reasons the North Galatian theory gets some effort, that if Paul was going this way and got stopped, about the only place to go would have been north, into Galatia, and so that's one of the ways they do that, reason that. 18:23, yeah, I think I've already read that. After he had spent some time, he went on into Galatia. Let's turn to the book of Galatians.
the things we're going to run into here, and I think it's a good place to get it started, is you probably heard the rhetoric of people love or hate Paul, right? What kind of things do you hear about Paul? Yeah, it could be. Yeah, you'll hear that kind of thing a lot. Now, I think a lot, I've corresponded and talked with lots of people who aren't believers. These are not people who look up and look at the Bible piously, like they're going to say, well, you know, they're going to yield to Paul. They'll say, no, Paul is like one voice, one perspective, one leader on the church in the first century, and his perspective is his perspective. Like, his opinion is his opinion. And so if I don't like his opinion, I can say, well, that guy, you know, Paul, I don't have to deal with Paul, do I? And you'll find a lot of, in the modern church, you don't have to go very far out into, you don't have to go into the wacky corners of the church to find people who are pretty dismissive of Paul and have found a way to try to kind of, you might say, contextualize him out of the picture. And in particular, on the issue of gender and sexuality, there those things where Paul's writing often are running into modern opinion about things or modern interest in things. The idea of trying to somehow or other invalidate or at least sort of neutralize what he says on those things, that's a big drive in not just outside the church, but even inside the church. And we have to deal with that, I think, you know, because that approach to Paul, that somehow or other his opinion can be, say quarantined back in the first century sometime or to specific churches in very specific contexts, well, that starts to work on me a great deal, because I don't see it that way. I mean, I don't see the Bible that way, that I can do that to him. So you say, all right, well, I'll take you when you're talking about love in 1 Corinthians 13, but if you start talking on these two subjects, my ears are closed. You are speaking as a first century man with first century prejudices and first century problems, and after all, it's just your opinion. Most evangelicals aren't going to go there, but believe me, it's coming to a theater, drive-in, or church near you. That approach to the Bible and that approach to Paul is very much among us, and you might want to, arm yourself as to how you're going to answer that. So to get started on this, then let's just see. How does Paul see what he's doing? See how he presents himself. How does he regard his message? Can I get somebody to read the very first verse of Galatians? Galatians 1:1. Okay. So, we have Paul, and what's he talking about here? An epistle has some rules. This is not, like I said, an email or a post-it note. This is a formal form. And so we usually start our letters with, Dear Chris. Except if it's a business letter, what's going to be first? Date and address. Who am I? Who's sending it to you? So we say, in this study of epistles, we say, I'm going to tell you who I am first. So this letter's going. So I am who? Paul, an apostle. And from where does that commission come? Yeah, so you say, how do you think of that? Because I'm Paul, I'm an apostle. And not through man. I'm not declaring any human agency giving me authority. I'm ordained by the Conservative Mennonite Conference. Steve Swartz himself has signed my card. You know, how you like that? You know, Paul doesn't say that. I'm an apostle, not by man, but through Jesus Christ, God the Father, who raised him from the dead. Well, so where does that leave you with Paul?
or,
yeah, oh yeah, I get you, and that's what I believe, but what would the alternative be? Yeah, and then what is he? Crazy, pompous, an idiot, dangerous, you know, I don't know, you know, you're sort of left with this position, so it's sort of like the old C.S. Lewis thing on Jesus Christ, you know, like, forget whether, you know, he couldn't be a good man. He's either a hopeless liar or who he says he is. You know, he's cracked. And I think what C.S. Lewis say, like, on the order of a man who considers himself a hard-boiled egg. Isn't that what he says? You know, I mean, you're like, I'm nuts, you know, I'm Napoleon or something. But Paul really throws down something here in the first sentence. Look, I'm not writing to you as, you know, speaking as the authorized agent of any human authority. I am sent, an apostle is one sent on a message, and it comes from God who raised Jesus from the dead. That's a very, very bold opening. Now we'll see, though, that it matters, because he's going to be coming back to his authority in this many, many times as he talks about what he's writing to them and how they received him at first and how they traveled away from that position. We're kind of coming down the home stretch here, and I want to finish within just a couple of minutes, but let's read, could somebody read us then the rest of it, 2 through 10? Okay, very good. This sets the theme for the rest of what we'll study for 8 weeks, in a sense. He's addressing people who have apparently drifted or replaced what he originally taught them. And he's going to try to come back and call them back to it. So if I can put something just in your minds to say, think about this, meditate on it this week, and then we come back and study it in some detail next week, is how does that happen? Remember that the people that he's addressing are Christians. I mean, he doesn't in any sense invalidate them as Christians. Say, well, you didn't really get it the first time. See if you can get it straight this time. I think he addresses them as people who got it and lost it, or are in the verge of losing it. And you think, how does that happen? How do you move from the gospel to the not gospel? I marvel that you are turning so soon away from him who called you in the grace of Christ to a different gospel. And we'll see that he'll keep coming back to that. Who has bewitched you? What happens? So I'm thinking, all right, one interpretation, many applications. We'll have to see what the Galatians did, but many applications. This apparently quite within the realm of Christian experience that this can happen to you. Say, what is likely to lure us? And we'll see what happened to them, and we've got to examine what could happen to us. So let's quit there, and we'll pick that up next week. Said we have 7 more lessons, so we can dig into the content deeply. Thanks.